Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated April 10th, 2015. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's cover story. Seriously, we could never get another professional franchise sports team. It's an impossible dream. Economics don't support another major team in the Triangle for decades. This article is written by Jason DeBrun. A sea of Duke University students wearing 2015 championship t-shirts packed Cameron Indoor Stadium on April 7th to welcome the men's basketball team back from their title run in Indianapolis. Although the championship sparks area pride even for some who don't bleed Duke blue, it also sits as a strong reminder that the Triangle will never get another major sports franchise, at least not for generations. Why? Because colleges in the Triangle suck up almost all of the disposable income in the form of tickets, merchandise, and related entertainment. In fact, based on population and income data, an argument can be made that this area can't even support the teams it has, despite a nearly continuous stream of rankings that put Raleigh and Durham at the top of almost any list. An analysis by American City Business Journals, the parent company of Triangle Business Journal, shows that the Triangle region needs a gross personal income of $128 billion just to support the Carolina Hurricanes, Duke Blue Devils, NC State Wolfpack, and UNC Tar Heels. Yet, according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the BEA, the area has a total personal income of only $87 billion, meaning that the Triangle lacks $41 billion of gross personal income just to properly support the teams that already exist here. I wouldn't go as far as to say that the Triangle will never get another major league franchise, but I certainly don't see it happening anytime in the near future, says Scott Dupree, executive director for the Greater Raleigh Sports Alliance. BEA, the Bureau of Economic Analysis, measures total personal income as the combined income of everyone in a particular geographic area. Since 2003, when this area's income totaled $51 billion, the Triangle's total personal income, TPI, has increased 7% per year, though on a constant dollar basis not adjusted for inflation. When making that adjustment, the Triangle's TPI has increased by about 3% per year above inflation, a steady growth, but one that would take decades to catch up $41 billion, let alone the additional income base to support a new team. ACBJ developed a metric that estimates a baseline TPI of a given area to support a major sports franchise. A National Hockey League team, for example, requires TPI of $50 billion, and major college programs need a base TPI of $26 billion each. Add those two together, and the TPI required for the existing teams is greater than what the Raleigh-Durham Metro has. ACBJ used official TPI data from 2013, the latest year for which statistics are available, from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis, and used team revenue data and average ticket prices to estimate the amount of TPI needed to adequately support a team in each of the professional leagues. In a household budget, families have only so much to spend on entertainment, but many sources are competing for that money. According to the latest estimates from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, BLS, entertainment spending actually decreased 1% last year to $2,560 per household, largely because of increasing health insurance costs. Entertainment expenditures make up roughly 5% of the average household's annual expenditures, according to the BLS. Food, housing, and transportation costs account for about two-thirds. Entertainment isn't cheap. Ticket packages to the Hurricanes range from $286 for an 11-game flex plan to as much as $8,000 for a front-row season ticket. In addition to a lack of personal income, the Triangle still lacks the corporate wealth base necessary to support more major franchises. Regarding the hurdles to a major league franchise here, the two biggest by far are a new stadium as it relates to the MLB and NFL and corporate support, says Tubery. Just my personal opinion, but I don't think the Triangle region could potentially support another major league franchise in terms of average attendance. But I'm not sure we could even come close to adequately supporting a new franchise in terms of sponsorships and corporate support. And getting the funding in place for a new stadium, that would cost hundreds of millions of dollars and seems unlikely at this point, or anytime soon. David Glenn, host of a statewide sports talk show, has held some concerns about major sports support for years. I thought it was a major, telling red flag years ago when Hurricanes majority owner Peter Karmanos wanted to find a dozen or more individual local investors for as little as $1 million each, and he really had a hard time with it, Glenn says. That had to be some serious combination of two things. Either there aren't as many North Carolinians with an extra $1 million laying around as many people think, or Karmanos was asking too high a price for those shares, or both. Clearly, there are a lot of people with significant wealth in North Carolina, but in my experience, there aren't as many financial heavyweights in the private sector here as most people think. Although experts agree that the bar to attracting a new major franchise is very high, most disagree that the Triangle lacks enough support for the existing teams. Jim Goodman, president and CEO of Capital Broadcasting Company, which owns the Durham Bulls, praises the fans. The success of the Durham Bulls and the Carolina Mudcats have shown that the Triangle is a strong, supportive regional market, he says. The Carolina Hurricanes made us a major league market, winning the Stanley Cup and promoting our region around the country. Going even one step further, Hill Caro, CEO of Sports and Properties Incorporated, a group that emphasizes sports and entertainment as economic development, disagreed that the Triangle would never get another major franchise, though he allowed, "I will agree that it will be challenging, mainly due to the high cost, limited team or franchise ability, availability, and highly competitive landscape nationally for landing a franchise," end quote. ACBJ looked at the top 83 markets in the United States and Canada. Charlotte, with two major sports teams, ranked 27th in terms of most likely to attract another franchise. The Queen City has a TPI of $103 billion, and because it has fewer teams, has a TPI surplus of $10 billion, putting it closer, by the ACBJ metric, to being able to support more sports teams. Determining what kind of major sport could fit into the Triangle requires an examination of factors beyond personal income and corporate support. ACBJ research estimates that an area would need an additional $104 billion of gross personal income to support a Major League Baseball franchise, largely because it has so many more home games, 81, than the other sports. In addition, however, the Triangle could not support the minor league teams in addition to a major league franchise. Market statistics clearly show that the Triangle is not large enough to support an MLB team, says Goodman. But the thought of the Bulls leaving Durham is nearly inconceivable to many, and not just to those in Durham. Although gross income required for teams in the other major franchises is less than the half requirements for MLB, there are other major roadblocks. Raleigh already has an NHL team, and the National Football League has the Carolina Panthers in Charlotte. Given the popularity of college basketball and the scheduling nightmare that would happen at PNC Arena if the Wolfpack, Hurricanes, and other professional team played there, a National Basketball Association team is unlikely. There's one sport that experts do give a chance: Major League Soccer. As we continue to grow, we're in a good position over the next 6 to 8 years to take the next step, a Major League Soccer team, says Goodman, a sentiment echoed by Caro, Dupree, and others. Soccer has long had a hold here and reflects our region's diversity and spirit. An MLS team requires an income base of only $14 billion, well below even college sports. The Carolina RailHawks, which play in the North American Soccer League, soccer's second division in the United States, has seen steady growth since new ownership took over the club. As soccer increases in popularity in the U.S., the MLS has been on a growth spurt. The league wants to expand to 24 teams by the end of the decade and already has plans in place to grow from 20 this year to 23 by the year 2018. An ownership group in Sacramento has been trying to get in, but soccer legend David Beckham could be putting the finishing touches in place to apply for a team in Miami. Of course, MLS could decide to expand further, but just last year the league counted only 18 teams among its ranks. Caro of Sports and Properties makes the case in favor of the triangle. While college sports needs an income base for support, universities simultaneously provide new waves of growth into the community. Support for the college teams shows that the area has a strong sports market, and no major league franchise is going to go to a market that hasn't demonstrated an affinity and significant support for sports, he says. The final key factor that makes the triangle an attractive location is our tremendous growth, Kara says. Teams or franchises have to have a long-term perspective, and the triangle is a much sought-after region in the long view. That is why the Hurricanes wanted to be here at the end of the 90s, and that is the perspective that a pro team will still have to have today. Having met with commissioners of some of the pro leagues personally, I can tell you that they always have their eyes on strong, long-term growth markets. This week's column on retail and restaurants by Amanda Hoyle indicates that the sporting goods market is coming up. How the new Cabela's and Garner stacks up against the other big sporting goods stores. The Cabela's Outfitter store opening April 16th in Garner will be upping the ante for the other new outdoor retail anchors that have been infiltrating the triangle these last couple of years, including Bass Pro Shops, Gander Mountain, and Field & Stream. Cabela's has proven to be a game-changer for nearly every market it's entered across the country, claiming to typically draw shoppers from as far as 200 miles away. The new store in Garner will be the company's 67th location in North America, but it will be the first store in North Carolina. Here's a comparison of the big outdoor retailers competing for customers in the Triangle. Cabela's. At 201 Cabela's Drive in Garner, the opening date is April 16, 2015, at 105,000 square feet. There are 245 employees, and the store features indoor mountain with double waterfalls, a 6,000-gallon aquarium, and 215 museum-quality animal mounts. Fresh deli and fudge shop, departments for hunting, fishing, archery, ammunition, camping, apparel, and home goods. There are no other North Carolina locations, and the company's headquarters are in Sidney, Nebraska. Next, Bass Pro Shops, 801 Bass Pro Lane in Cary. The opening date was February 2014, with a square footage of 105,000 square feet. There are 200 employees. The store features a living museum of the central North Carolina region, featuring area artifacts, antiques, period pictures, state record wildlife mounts, and memorabilia. Other North Carolina locations include Concord. The company headquarters are in Springfield, Missouri. Next, Field & Stream at 1048 Parkside Main Street in Cary. The opening date was September 2014. 50,000 square feet, and there are 100 employees at this triangle store. Like a Dick's sporting goods store with specialty areas designated inside various departments geared towards certain hobbies and work needs, including archery, hunting, ammunition, fishing, and camping. There are no other North Carolina locations, and the company headquarters with the parent company is Dick's Sporting Goods is in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Gander Mountain. Two triangle locations, 2100 Village Marketplace in Morrisville and 6101 Capitol Boulevard in Raleigh. The opening date in Morrisville was October 2012 and in Raleigh in February of 2014. Each store has about 51,000 square feet. There are approximately 70 employees at each store, and the store features a large selection of hunting and fishing, camping, and other outdoor equipment. Other North Carolina locations featured are Fayetteville, Gastonia, Greensboro, Monroe, Mooresville, Charlotte, and Winston-Salem. The company's headquarters is in St. Paul, Minnesota. Next up, the retail buzz. Bojangles Incorporated files for an IPO for restaurant expansion. The Charlotte-based Bojangles Incorporated on April 6th filed an initial public stock offering to raise funds for an aggressive restaurant expansion plan. It plans to list on the NASDAQ under the symbol BOJA, the prospectus says. To date, the company has not determined the number of shares nor the price per share of its initial offering. Bojangles had 254 company-operated and 368 franchise restaurants that generated more than $1 billion in system-wide sales in fiscal 2014. And Red Hot and Blue sets a targeted opening date in Cary. Red Hot and Blue, a Memphis-style barbecue restaurant, is targeting April 20th, opening date in Cary. It's the same location it previously occupied at 325 New Waverly Place. And Flower Power opens a second Triangle location. Flower Power, the Raleigh-based cooking studio concept for children, has returned to the North Raleigh Shopping Center of its original location after opening its third studio shop on April 3rd in the Falls River Town Center retail shops. Flower Power, which changed its name from Little Chef Kids Cooking Studio last fall, had opened its first location at Falls River in 2009 and relocated to North Hills in Raleigh in 2011. Since then, it has also opened a location in Charlotte. Founder Susan Caldwell says she expects to begin offering franchise opportunities for the Flower Power concept by June 2015 and will be opening a fourth location in Cary in fall 2015. And lastly, Durham Bowls to partner with Rise Biscuits and Donuts owner. A month after the Durham Bulls baseball team announced the formation of its own food and beverage company to take over all concessions at its downtown baseball park, the team announced a new partnership with Rise Biscuits and Donuts owner Tom Ferguson. Ferguson's Durham Catering Company has been hired to handle all catering for guests at the baseball's 10 luxury suites, including the buffet-style service at the members-only PNC Triangle Club event space behind home plate. Rise Biscuits and Donuts will also be opening a new Rise Donuts kiosk on the concourse. Amanda Hoyle's column on real estate continues with the top commercial building sales of March. Major commercial property sales in the Triangle have topped $665 million for the first quarter in 2015, with March sales adding $153 million following several mid-level apartment property trades. The largest deal of March was a trio of apartment properties in Raleigh that were sold late in the month by a national apartment investment firm, McDowell Properties, for a combined $41.8 million, according to county records. McDowell had paid $27.1 million for the same properties in 2006, including the Trestles of Raleigh, Timbers, and Remington Place apartment communities. These properties listed are Summer Mill Apartments in Raleigh with 320 units and a price of $39.5 million. Thornhill Apartments in Raleigh, 318 units. The price was $31 million. Concourse Office Building in Morrisville has 132,268 square feet at a price of $16.5 million. Briarcliff Apartments in Raleigh has a building size of 248 units. Its price is $16 million. Trestles of Raleigh Apartments in Raleigh, 280 units, $15.1 million. Timbers Apartments in Raleigh, 176 units, $13.3 million. And Remington Place Apartments in Raleigh with 136 units and a price of $13.2 million. Bringing up the rear is ECPI Office Building in Raleigh. It's 51,903 square feet at a price of $8 million. Next up, proposed Solil Center site goes on the block. Rialto Capital, the Florida owners of the nearly 5-acre site approved 10 years ago for a 43-story hotel and condo tower, have decided to put the property up for sale. Put it up for auction. Rialto Capital had put the land located on 4501 Creedmoor Road in Raleigh back on the market for sale back in the fall with an asking price of $7.5 million, but there have been no serious offers so far. Bids are set to start at $1.5 million, but Rialto also has set a reserve price, or a minimum selling price, should none of the bids meet its minimum price needs. In March, Rialto Capital refiled site plans for the Solil Center site with the Raleigh Planning Department that had been initially approved by the city in 2005 in order to preserve its entitlements. The plans would have allowed for what would have become the tallest building in Raleigh, with as many as 290 hotel rooms and 54 residential condominiums. And finally, for this week's column on real estate by Amanda Hoyle, Duke Realty finalizes sale of Triangle Office Portfolio, and Manning joins King Realty. A joint venture among three private investment partners led by Charlotte-based Trinity Capital Advisors on April 1st finalized its $1.1 billion acquisition of 62 suburban office properties owned by National Real Estate Investment Trust, Duke Realty Corporation, in four key real estate markets in North Carolina, Tennessee, Missouri, and Florida. The off-market acquisition deal was first announced in January and includes 6.9 million square feet of office space that was 90% leased at the time of the deal, plus 57 acres of undeveloped land. In the triangle, the partnership purchased 24 buildings in Morrisville, Cary, and Raleigh, plus 50 acres of undeveloped land at Perimeter Park in Morrisville. The Triangle portfolio totals more than 3 million square feet with a tenant base that includes 90 tenant companies. Trinity Capital Advisors partners in the deal were Starwood Capital Group and Vanderbilt Partners. The Trinity Partners commercial brokerage and property management firm will take over leasing duties from Duke Realty for the Triangle properties. Duke Realty's former Vice President of Leasing and Development, Hooker Manning, has since accepted a position at Kane Realty Corporation in Raleigh as Director of Office, Leasing, and Development. Next up, Jason DeBruin's column on pharma. His column this week leads with an article entitled, "Another Blow Dealt to the Triangle Pharma Industry. RTP Loses Out to Maryland for GSK's New Vaccine Center." Research Triangle Park never received much consideration as a location for GlaxoSmithKline to put a new global center for vaccine research and development, primarily because RTP never supported much of GSK's vaccine business. "We don't do any vaccines, R&D, in RTP, and we only have a handful of employees here who support vaccines," according to Melinda Stubbe, GSK Director of Global External Communications. "The location was selected because in Rockville, Maryland, we have a state-of-the-art facility that meets our demands for the size and technological capability required for vaccines R&D. It is also in close proximity to Washington, D.C. and our key U.S. stakeholders." London-based GSK will consolidate its U.S. vaccine research to make the Rockville site one of its three global vaccine and R&D centers. Key late-stage development programs, as well as vaccine discovery and new platform technology development, will be led from Rockville, the company said. GSK has announced more than 1,000 layoffs from its facilities in RTP, partly from a consolidation of research and development work here. However, GSK did very little vaccine work here locally. "We only have a handful of people in RTP who work in vaccines R&D, so this consolidation won't have an impact on them," according to Stubbe. GSK expanded its vaccine portfolio after a $25 billion asset swap with Novartis. Already vaccines had pushed their way into the GSK portfolio, growing from 9% of sales in 2007 to 14% of sales in 2013 and 2014. Naturally, with the addition of Novartis' rather sizable vaccine offerings, GSK will see that percentage increase as it will become the number one producer of vaccines when the deal closes. Next up, Valeant announces 258 layoffs at Raleigh's Salix facility. One day after Valeant Pharmaceuticals International closed its acquisition of Raleigh's Salix Pharmaceuticals, the company announced it would lay off 258 workers in North Carolina. The Salix layoffs will impact a wide range of job functions. Workers have been notified and layoffs began April 1st and will continue through October 30th. Valeant acquired Salix for $11 billion in cash or $173 per share. Layoffs don't come as a surprise to those who watch the pharma industry. Valeant's model has long been to acquire companies with promising drugs to sell and then to do just that, especially since Michael Pearson took over in 2008. The layoffs will not affect the Salix sales force. In both 2013 and 2014, Valeant spent just 3% of its total revenue on R&D. In 2012, it was 2%. By comparison, Salix spent 19% of total revenue on research and development from 2009 through 2013. Even in 2014, when Salix had grown into a more mature drug-selling company, it still pumped $170 million, 15% of total revenue, into R&D. Other major drug companies spend as much as 20% or more on R&D and have pipelines with dozens of products, some in early stages of development. That's simply not Valeant's business model. David Ridley, the faculty director of health sector management and Duke University's Fuqua School of Business, predicted that Salix employees could be at risk but pointed out a silver lining that this could lead to a new pharma startup companies going forward. Next up, question and answer with Christian Heyman, serving as director at Vaco Raleigh. Since December 1st, there have been 4,346 major layoff notices in the Triangle. In the rest of 2014, combined, there were 7,322 major layoff announcements. Some of these workers, many in the life science sectors, received severance packages but will turn back to the market to find a job. When you are laid off, that is really jarring, says Christian Heyman, managing director of recruiting firm Vaco Raleigh's executive search. It's emotionally tough on you and your family. Triangle Business Journal asks the question, what are some of the first things a worker should do after being notified of a layoff? Mr. Heyman replies, find out as much as you can, know what your options are, then connect with your network to find out what opportunities are available to you. TBJ, these events are a good reminder for those who weren't laid off. What are some good practices for workers in general? Mr. Heyman, if we learn anything over the past 10 years, it's that people aren't going to have the same jobs for their careers. Not only are workers generally not interested in that anymore, but companies don't offer that stability anymore. So you should stay current in your field. If you haven't been doing that, you're going to be left behind. Connect with a recruiter or someone who is up on the jobs marketplace. You should check in every 3 to 6 months and build that relationship. It's the old adage, you don't want to introduce yourself and ask for a favor in the same call. Triangle Business Journal. What industries are hiring in the Triangle? Mr. Heyman. Healthcare continues to do really well, especially companies that merge technology and healthcare. Technology is obviously doing well, and so is life sciences, even with the recent layoffs. TBJ, how closely do other companies pay attention to big layoff announcements? Mr. Heyman, very closely. So, for example, a Quintiles or a LabCorp will have a deliberate meeting will have to deliberate meetings to target workers from GSK or Salix who they think would be a good fit. The good thing here is that we have a growing economy. TBJ, but an area can only absorb so many jobs. Are we nearing a tipping point with GSK, Hospira, and Salix all announcing layoffs in such a short time? Mr. Heyman, I don't think so. Look at MetLife as just one example. 2 years ago, they had basically zero employees. Now they have more than 1,000. If 1,000 people were to be dropped out of the sky right now with good skills, I really believe they would find jobs in 3 months. Continuing on the column by Jason DeBruin, he talks about the economy. And this subject matter contains information about the foreign trade. North Carolina exports drop, but so does trade deficit. Exports out of North Carolina decreased in February, but because of fewer imports, the trade deficit decreased as well. Figures released by the U.S. Census Bureau and the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis through the Department of Commerce show exports decreased about 4% compared with January and about 3% compared with February 2014. But the decrease in imports decreased the trade deficit. Through the first 2 months of 2015, North Carolina ran a trade deficit of $3.2 billion, an 11% decrease from the same period last year. Nationally, the goods and services deficit decreased $2.6 billion, or 3.2%, on a year-to-date basis compared with 2014. Exports decreased $5.3 billion, or 1.4%. Imports decreased $7.9 billion, or 1.7%. Next up, local workers rally for higher minimum wage. A group of low-wage workers gathered in front of a Durham McDonald's fast food restaurant to call for North Carolina to institute a higher minimum wage. North Carolina is among 21 states in which workers can earn the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. April 1 marked the day in which Seattle's minimum wage law takes effect. Wages will increase for workers in the city to $11 and ramp up to $15 by 2021. Fast food workers across the nation plan to strike April 15th, a day that symbolically represents their demands for a higher minimum wage. Fast food workers have sparked a movement that is changing this country, says George Hargrove, a McDonald's worker who first participated in the fast food strikes 2 years ago in Raleigh. People thought we were crazy to call for $15 an hour, but all across the country, cities, states, and employers are raising wages significantly because of the stand we are taking. The arguments for and against a higher minimum wage break neatly down macroeconomic ideological lines. The baseline conservative argument posits that a higher minimum wage would increase unemployment because business owners have a fixed fund from which they pull labor costs. If each laborer takes up more of that pot, then the employer can't employ as many people. A liberal economist would argue that a raise in minimum wage would put more money in the pockets of working families, giving them more opportunity to patronize businesses and thereby helping employers grow and create jobs. Joining fast food workers in North Carolina on April 15th will be home care and child care workers and will meet with student child care workers and meet with student leaders in the NCAA. CP and others at Shaw University for a mass rally. I've worked in child care for 30 years, and after all that time, I make only $8.25 an hour. This isn't just our fight. It's for every hardworking person who is living on the brink. We have strength in numbers, says Corin Hall, a Raleigh child care worker. We won't stop until we are all paid better and we listened to as early childhood educators. In November, San Francisco became the third city in the United States to adopt a $15 minimum wage. Since the first fast food strike in 2012, 9 million low-wage workers have gotten raises through local ballot measures, city and state legislation, contract negotiations, and employer policy changes. More workers than are in private sector unions in the entire country. And the outlook for the future? Economic forecast, more cautious optimism. North Carolina business owners are optimistic about higher sales and even higher profits, but still won't commit to a hiring boom or a broad wage increase for workers, according to a PNC Economic Outlook report. I think there is a certain degree of cautious optimism, says PNC economist Michael Tesholm. Top line survey results show that 80% of business owners are optimistic about their company's prospects, and those very optimistic have risen from 6 months ago. Local business optimism has increased significantly, with 66% of owners now optimistic about the U.S. economy, compared with 48% in the fall. Still, this optimism doesn't seem to trickle down to the employees. Only 19% of the business owners plan to add full-time employees, and 31% expect to increase employees' pay. Tesholm, who has held an optimistic view of the North Carolina economy for several quarters, predicts hiring and wages will soon follow. While employment in North Carolina has ticked up, it has not fully rebounded. The labor market still needs to lighten up a little bit more before workers feel the real benefits, says Tesholm, something he predicts will happen in 2016. This week's column by Lauren Onisorge concerns funding. And in the IPO corner, there's a report of venture-backed IPOs drop in the first quarter of 2015. Venture-backed IPOs sank in the first quarter of 2015, the same quarter that brought us MaxPoint Interactive's debut in March. Across the country, 17 venture-backed IPOs raised $1.4 billion in the quarter, a 54% decrease in the number of offerings from the first quarter of last year, and a 58% decrease in dollars compared to 1 year ago. That's according to a report by Thomson Reuters and the National Venture Capital Association, which also notes that this quarter is the first to see less than 20 venture-backed IPOs since the first quarter of 2013. Of the 17 venture-backed IPOs, 2 were in information technology, 13 were in life sciences, and 2 were in non-high technology. For the first quarter of 2015, the report shows 86 venture-backed merger and acquisition deals were reported. 16 of those deals had an aggregate deal value of $2.1 billion. Venture-backed M&A declined to its lowest levels by both deal number and value since the first quarter of 2013. Bobby Franklin, president and CEO of NVCA, said that with such a blistering pace for exits in 2014, it was only a matter of time before the numbers dropped. With 54 venture-backed companies having already filed publicly for IPOs and many more confidential registrations already in place, we are optimistic that the pace for venture-backed exits will pick up steam as the year moves ahead, creating opportunities for everyday investors to be shareholders of innovation, he says. Continuing on Lauren Onisorge's column of funding, Film grants, three and done. 2 months after soliciting Hollywood Productions, the North Carolina Film Office announced that it had officially maxed out its $10 million grant budget with 3 investments. That means cash is no longer a weapon at Guy Gaster's disposal. Gaster, director of the North Carolina Film Office, is tasked with leading Hollywood recruitment efforts. He's aware how close Georgia is, a state doling out 30% film incentives to production companies. He also knows that blockbuster projects like Iron Man 3 are going to follow the money, so Gaster is changing his strategy. Instead of courting the next Hunger Games, he's expanding his energy on battles he can win, smaller projects that may not even meet the minimum for types of incentives Georgia offers. He's using North Carolina's physical attributes to clinch deals, such as its coastline, mountains, and cityscapes. He's recruiting commercial projects, which are more about the location, he says. Film activity in North Carolina isn't limited to grant-funded projects, he says, pointing to an independent feature, Bolden, which didn't apply for financial support. HGTV's Love It or List It, which is filming in the Triangle, and My Big Fat Fabulous Life, the TLC reality show currently filming in Greensboro. The 3 chosen projects will be exciting for the state, he says, adding that the yet-to-be-titled Lionsgate production to be filmed in southwest North Carolina should be announced in the coming weeks, but this could be an entirely different conversation in July. By July, legislatures could make the decision to infuse more cash into the grant program or rework the way films are incentivized entirely. Gaster says that could put him back at the blockbuster discussion table. Commerce officials and legislatures alike have acknowledged that the current program isn't ideal. In March, Secretary of Commerce John Sclavara admitted there is a wide gap between the $10 million North Carolina is offering and what filmmakers can find elsewhere. They set up shop wherever anyone's giving them the best credits, and they'll admit that, he says. But he points out that film incentives may be a tougher sell than broader economic incentives. After all, when $10 million is used to lure a company, it's usually dependent upon jobs, not just dollars funneled into a project. And companies stick around longer than the typical feature film, contributing to an entire state's tax base. With films, he pointed out, the benefit is primarily isolated to the shooting area. Returns on a state level, he said, are difficult to quantify. Gaster says he'll continue to sell the state, whether incentive grants or even nothing is offered, but it won't be easy. The three productions combined will result in more than $60 million in direct spending in North Carolina. For perspective, Iron Man 3, which filmed in Raleigh in 2012, spent about $81 million in the state. Under the old tax incentive program, that production received a rebate of $20 million from North Carolina. The film projects that won a piece of the $10 million grant are Under the Dome in Wilmington, which will receive $5 million and is expected to spend $35 million in the state, Untitled Lionsgate Television Project, which will receive about $4 million and will spend $16 million in the state, Late Last Season, which will be shot at the Davidson College campus and which will receive $1 million in grant funds and spend $10 million in the state. Lauren Onisores also covers technology in the Triangle, and this article is entitled Matty Energy Wins Google Demo Day. 3 years ago, Matty Energy founder Titania Biggerson was brewing tea in her Duke University dorm room. This April, cans of her concoction, which purportedly have more caffeine than a Red Bull, were in the hands of Silicon Valley investors. And on April 2nd, Biggerson was hit with two victories, the top pitch title at Google Demo Day and a $100,000 investment from AOL co-founder Steve Case. Prior to that, she received just more than $90,000 in institutional investment. Matty Energy, based in Durham's American Underground, has already linked partnerships with Whole Foods, Kroger, and Costco, but in spite of this, she didn't think she'd win the title. After all, a competitive analysis showed the company she was up against, from a technology that charges your phone while you walk to another that customizes climates at individual workspaces in the same building, and had raised more money. She raised about a tenth that of her competitors, she says, and while she had just hired her first two employees, most of her competition had already compiled teams of between 10 and 20 people. I was blown away by how great the other teams were, she says. In addition to the actual demo day, Biggerson lined up multiple appointments with investors while in Silicon Valley, and those too are paying off. She expects to be able to close on her next round of capital in the next 2 months. And meet Lenovo, North America's new leader. Lenovo's new North American chief is packing up and flying to Raleigh-Durham International Airport this weekend to properly assess his new domain. The mission is clear, to further solidify the Chinese computer maker's brand in the United States. Amar de Liquesion heard the news 10 days ago that he'd be leaving his post over EMEA, Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, and head North American operations for Lenovo. It's news that analysts such as TBR's Jack Narcotta are calling a continuation of Lenovo's protect and attack strategy. What they're looking to do is, we think, bring some of that momentum that they were able to generate in EMEA and bring that to the States, Narcotta says. Fortunately for his transition, he's no stranger to planes. The father of four plans to continue to maintain his primary residence in London. In his position over EMEA, he covered territories in 120 countries. I've literally been on the road 5 days a week, every week, so the notion of home is a notion of where my family is, he says. And it's convenient that RDU's sole one-stop flight across the Atlantic rests in London, because he'll be spending the majority of the time, he pledges, right here in the Triangle. This is our main hub in the United States, he says. This is where most of the teams are. Specifics as to his strategy are still being finalized, but next week his first trek to the Triangle campus as its boss is all about listening. This week's He Said It column is led by John Gaither. He was noted as saying, there is nothing ceasing here in Durham. Mr. Gaither is president and CEO of Reichhold, a Durham chemical company that makes coatings, such as those for automobiles. Gaither says Reichhold is emerging from bankruptcy and is hiring. Also, there's a buyout. Durham's two toasters acquired by Ticketmaster. Ticketmaster, a division of Live Nation Entertainment, just acquired Durham app developer Two Toasters for an undisclosed sum. According to Two Toasters, some roles may be changing, but Durham employees will keep their jobs. The 32-person firm will remain in Durham operating under a new name, Ticketmaster Mobile Studio. The company had little to say about the news, but it did confirm the deal on its website, saying it further demonstrates Ticketmaster's commitment to expanding its mobile capacity. Two Toasters was founded by brothers Rashid and Adit Shakula and has launched more than 50 mobile products. And now it's time for A Better World. News in the philanthropy world by Mr. Todd Cohen. Girls on the Run, Running Faster. While Julie Allen Simpson Voss is not a fast runner, she says she can put in the miles, go the distance. She has learned through training for several marathons that you have to have multiple stages to approach the challenge, but can be successful, which isn't measured by winning, but how much you approach it. That philosophy helps drive Girls on the Run of the Triangle, a Durham nonprofit Simpson Voss heads that uses physical activity and running as tools to help girls through the region build character and courage. Founded in 2000 and part of Charlotte-based international network of local groups that serve more than 200 cities, Girls on the Run of the Triangle operates with an annual budget of $450,000, a staff of 3 full-time employees and 3 part-time employees, and roughly 600 volunteers, and will serve 1,600 girls in grades 3 through 5 this year, 3 times the total it served 4 years ago. 2/3 of the girls are from Wake County, and the others are split roughly evenly between Durham and Orange counties. Girls participate in a 24-course program offered over 12 weeks in the fall and again in the spring, hosted at public and private schools, after-school youth programs, and churches. Each program culminates with a 5K event. While girls train for the 5K, they also learn about practice strategies and skills such as goal setting, communication, and teamwork to build their confidence and self-esteem and address problems such as conflicts, bullying, and peer pressure. A group of 4 girls might be given a scenario, for example, in which a boy seated behind them in class is copying their work. Each girl would then be asked, while running a lap, to compose a phrase to respond to the boy. On completing the lap, the girls would share their responses, then they would be given a new scenario for their next lap. They're thinking and doing something while running, Simpson Voss says. Girls on the Run generate 65% of its revenue through fees and the rest through contributions. Participation in the 12-week program costs $200, and 1/3 of the girls receive a scholarship. The nonprofit aims to be serving nearly 2,200 girls a year by 2017. It also wants to expand the program to include older girls and women, beginning with a pilot this fall that will add 1 middle school each in Wake, Durham, and Orange counties, and add another 10 to 12 middle schools the following spring. Eventually, Girls on the Run will expand to include high school girls as junior coaches, more college girls as coaches, as well as mothers who serve as coaches or encourage their daughters to participate. The idea is to provide programming that serves the entire life cycle of a girl and a continuation of these ideas and values, Simpson-Voss says. Having the ability to understand who you are and what you're made of and what your values are is the foundation for courage. This week's Editor's Notebook is by Sukarta Mukherjee, the editor of Triangle Business Journal. Mr. Mukherjee's column is entitled, Coach K Delivers Priceless Lesson for Us. Having been a Carolina fan for years, and also quietly rooting for the NC State Wolfpack, for me, the Duke University Blue Devils basketball program remained an obstacle to the ultimate goal. For years, I cringed and cried foul every time Duke beat its Triangle rivals, and every time they advanced deeper than the Tar Heels and the Wolfpack in the NCAA tournament. Lately, that has happened quite a bit. But this time, watching them win the men's basketball national championship, I was left in awe. Not because they won with four freshmen on the team, not because Wisconsin did the dirty work for them in the semifinals by beating the unbeaten Kentucky team, but because of their basketball coach, Mike Krzyzewski. Coach K may have won five titles, but in his 34 seasons at the Durham School, I believe this was his finest coaching moment. After watching this game, it is hard to make an argument that coaches can't change the outcome of a game. You hear that argument all the time. The players on the court are the ones that decide the final result. Agreed, but it is the coach that creates the winning environment. Coach K was at the top of his game on April 6th. He saw the inadequacies of his players, made some bold adjustments, and instructed some of his players to attack and defend in a fashion that was not part of the regular regime. And they won. Even after losing an All-American in midseason, even when two of their top players were in foul trouble, and even when it looked like the opponents had the momentum. It was Coach K's ability to adjust and inject belief in his players that led to the win. This 68-year-old group texts with his players, listens to rap music, and even dances to pop tunes, all in an effort to relate to his players, some of whom will stay with him for just 1 year. During the off-season, Krzyzewski often talks to business groups and leadership institutions and is paid tens of thousands of dollars in speaker's fees. He talks about leadership, motivation, challenges, and strategies at these forums. He needs to add another segment to his speech, doing more with less. To me, he may well be a chief strategist of a large corporation. The way he reviews a game, then adjusts and executes, is a trait that almost every business needs in their arsenal. It's a commodity that is rare. I will continue to root for the Tar Heels and the Wolfpack, but I will also look up to how Coach K strives to deliver his team to the world every year with a different look but the same outcome, a championship. You should know that the Golden Corral's Camp Kicks Off campaign. Golden Corral kicked off a campaign to raise $1.7 million to support Camp Corral, a summer camp for children of wounded, disabled, or fallen military service members. If it meets the goal, Golden Corral will send 3,200 military children to one of Camp Corral's week-long camps offered in 19 states this summer. And Passage Home Flights, Area Homelessness. Passage Home, a nonprofit fighting poverty and homelessness in Wake County, has partnered with the J.D. Lewis Multiple Purpose Center to raise a $250,000 in 2015 for its Building a Stronger Raleigh Together campaign. The campaign seeks to raise funds to combat issues facing local families struggling to make ends meet, including access to stable housing, healthy food, education, jobs, and more. In order to reach their goal, the organizations are hosting several fundraising events throughout the year. And GSK sparks kids' interest in science. GlaxoSmithKline Science in the Summer Free Educational Program is going national. It's expanding to 12 additional locations this summer, reaching 3,000 more kids. Globally, GSK is working to engage more than 2.5 million young people in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics by 2020 through programs like GSK Science in the Summer. You may think of April Fool's Day as a childhood pursuit, but some businesses enjoyed pranking their customers on April 1st. The Carolina Mudcats announced the limited availability of special water tower seating for fans at the suspicious price of $401. Slim's in downtown Raleigh started rumors that the restaurant entrepreneur Ashley Christensen had bought the bar, and Christensen played it up with gusto on social media. And even the genteel Southern Living magazine got into the spirit, announcing and later admitting the joke, a new dating site for Southern singles called Southern Lovin'. Durham promotes water conservation, and the city of Durham is participating in a national water conservation challenge during the month of April. Mayor William Bill Bell and the city's water management department are encouraging residents to sign up at mywaterpledge.com and participate in the Weiland Foundation's Mayor's Challenge for Water Conservation. Last year, Durham finished fifth place, but Bell hopes to best that ranking in 2015. As Durham continues to grow, our water resources will be stretched to meet increases in demand, Bell says. By participating in the National Mayor's Challenge for Water Conservation, residents can pledge to make Durham a more sustainable community, both now and in the future. Keep it boring in Raleigh. House of Swank, a popular pop-up purveyor of North Carolina-themed t-shirts and gear, has launched a permanent shop in downtown Raleigh. The mobile store has been a regular feature at local festivals and music events. One of its most recent creations is the Keep It Raleigh Boring t-shirt, an in-your-face response to the Charlotte Observer columnist who called Raleigh boring in an opinion piece. The new 3,000-square-foot shop, located at 315 South Bloodworth Street, will host a Swank Fest and grand opening April 11th from 4 p.m. to 11 p.m. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at www.triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.